Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us here. Sunday morning wake-up call in 2022. Happy New Year to all the listeners today. We're going to be talking about legal guardianship and the elderly, especially. Our guest today, Katie Caverly. She is the owner, managing director of ICOR here in Charlottesville. We also have Doris Gelman from Gelman Law, where she focuses and exclusively practices elder law here in the Charlottesville area. Ladies, welcome. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having us.
You've both been on before, and we've spoken about legal and issues with the elderly and care for the elderly. And today, we're going to talk about guardianship. So, Doris, can you define legal guardianship? And then another word that I learned in preparation, conservatorship.
Yeah, sure. And this is particular to Virginia. It is different from state to state. In Virginia, we have something called guardianship, which is when the court makes a decision about who will be making decisions for someone else. For example, grandma is no longer able to decide what doctor to see and isn't able to get there, and somebody has to take over decision making for her. Conservatorship, by contrast, is about the person's stuff. And by stuff, I mean property, bank accounts, money, anything having to do with their financial situation. That's what conservatorship concerns. It can be the same person acting in both capacities.
But when the court decides these, who's going to take on these roles, is that at the request of someone else, a family member, a friend, someone in a social care role to be that points out that grandma needs a guardian and needs a conservator? Or, I mean, how does this happen?
Well, this is a very formal court process. It's a trial. So the way it gets initiated is by petition. It's a civil matter. So virtually anybody can petition for guardianship. It can be a family member. It can be, a professional caregiver. It can be the Department of Social Services, virtually anyone. I have cases, for example, where a nursing home has petitioned to have a guardian named for someone that's in their care because there isn't anyone else to make decisions. So it's virtually anyone, and it's done in a formal way. A petition is filed with the court, and then there are another bunch of steps that come after that. But that's to answer your initial question, how that's happened.
Katie Caverly, who's the owner and managing director of ICOR Charlottesville, not everyone knows what ICOR is and does, and the name nursing home popped out there. Can you talk about what ICOR does and why you would be invited on this topic?
Yeah, sure. We're a geriatric care management firm, although increasingly people drop the geriatric, and certainly in ICOR's case, we have some quite young clients, but predominantly we function like surrogate family members. So I've got registered nurses on staff who are patient advocates. They can attend doctor's appointments, take a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, show up in an emergency department, manage medicines, become the historian of record when our clients are poor historians of their own medical history. We have bookkeepers on staff who can help with simple bill pay. And we have concierges, what we call personal needs coordinators, who are kind of this combination of the silly and sublime. you know, these past holidays, we were hanging some wreaths on doors for Christmas, on up to we can handle an appeal for a Medicare denial or help people get on claim for long-term care insurance and whatnot. So, like I say, we sort of think of ourselves as surrogate sons and daughters, but with the professionalism of registered nurses, bookkeepers, a social worker, and concierges. So we help people predominantly through the aging process.
How does that business come about? Is that, I won't follow up with that. How does that sort of business come about?
There are a couple of ways. Sometimes the elder contacts us themselves, and that's often ideal insofar they're recognizing that they may need some support. So they'll contact us and they'll ask, could we serve as agent under power of attorney, be it durable or healthcare, meaning they recognize that they may, hopefully not, but they may reach a point in their life where they can no longer make their own decisions, and they're sitting with an attorney like Doris, completing power of attorney documents, and they want to name an agent, and they'll ask that I-Corps serve in that role. So that's one avenue. Sometimes it is the adult child. What is a common occurrence is an adult child, typically remote, right? Somebody who lives out of state comes home and visits mom or dad and becomes a bit concerned about how they are faring independently. And they'll hire I-Corps, and we'll go in and perform an assessment. We'll sort of look at what is the current condition of existence? How can we improve it? How can we stabilize it? Is another avenue. And then often third-party professionals. So elder attorneys like Doris, estate attorneys, sometimes wealth advisors, money managers, sometimes the Department of Social Services will reach out to us. It's really anybody who recognizes that someone needs a little support to go about the day-to-day management of their life, and they'll reach out to us. So it can be any number of avenues, but again, sometimes it is the elder themselves, but sometimes it's a loving family member or a concerned professional.
Doris, why do we have two different roles here? Why can't guardian automatically be the conservator? Why are they split?
Well, sometimes you have someone that's appropriate for making decisions about someone's what we call the person or their health care, but is not really able to manage the money. And I'll give you an example where you have a husband and a wife, and the husband perhaps has developed dementia and is no longer able to make any of these decisions, whether it's about money or whether it's about which nursing home to go to or any of the other things. And the wife, through the course of their marriage, has never been involved in their finances and doesn't understand it, doesn't know how to manage the money, or is herself a little, having some memory problems or anything of that nature. But she can still make decisions about her husband's health, or at least participate in those decisions. So she may be named as guardian, and someone else, a professional fiduciary, or another person better qualified to fill that role. The other way this comes up is sometimes people don't need a conservator at all. And the best example of that I can think of is when you have, it often happens with disabled children who either developmentally disabled or some other problem, and they don't have any assets, they don't have any money. The only income they have is coming from Social Security in the form of disability, and that can be assigned to something called a representative payee, which is something Social Security does to direct money to the person that's managing it outside of the state guardianship scheme altogether. I will say that I very often use the term guardian or guardianship to refer to both guardian and conservator, just because it's awkward to have to say both.
Is that a hint?
Do as you please. Well, when it's necessary to distinguish, I will.
as we talk about legal guardianship and the elderly with Doris Gelman, who has her own legal practice, Gelman Law, and she exclusively practices elder law here in Charlottesville. We also have Katie Caverly. She's the managing director and owner at ICOR Charlottesville. There has been a lot of negativity around the aspect of guardianship and conservatorship, most of it to do with the Free Britney and the Britney Spears aspect. Please speak about that a bit, Doris.
Well, I think if you look at the sort of history of that situation, most of us will agree that Britney Spears needed someone to manage her affairs, both personally and to get her some help and to manage her money, which was extensive, quite a large amount of money that she was earning. In order to do that, she was an adult when the time came, and she was drinking and had some psychiatric issues and whatnot. They went to court and they sought the naming of a conservator for her, which I'm not sure in California whether those two are embodied together, guardian and conservator. I believe they are. And they named her father as her conservator. So he managed all of her life decisions. I don't know what the nomenclature in California is. Until she got to a point where she began to feel like she didn't need a conservator anymore, and she petitioned the court to release her from the conservatorship. And that's kind of where the story begins. The bits and pieces of it came out that he had been abusive, that he had used the money for his own purposes, that he was making her do things to make money that she didn't really want to do, all sorts of things like that. So that's where that story came to. And over a long course of time, she fought the court order and ultimately won and has been released from the conservatorship. They had an interim person take over from the father at one point. And there were various lawyers that went in and out of that picture as well. A lot of money got wasted along the way.
Katie, have you, as we move onward in age from Britney Spears and the younger age group back to the elderly, because that's one thing that is often discussed with the elderly is who is taking advantage of them. And I think that sort of seems to be the foundation of guardianship. If they can't take care of themselves in a safe manner, then someone else may take advantage of that. Am I correct?
Yeah, elder exploitation is pretty rampant. It is often underreported and, frankly, under-prosecuted. And there's so much shame involved. Most of the times, the person exploiting an elder is someone well known to them. You know, we think of a scammer on the internet taking advantage, and that certainly happens. But more often than not, it's somebody who is abusing their position of trust. So it could be a family member or a caregiver, or we went through a strange rash of landscapers a couple of years ago. I can't describe why, but we kept having issues where, in one example, a landscaper was charging an elderly client who lived on about a half acre, $800 a week to mow her lawn. And so that exploitation is something that a guardianship is entitled to either prevent or correct insofar, and I use the wrong nomenclature, I should have said conservatorship, insofar the conservator will marshal and ring fence and protect the assets. Literally meaning that a checking account that a client or the ward had in their own name is closed, and there is a new checking account opened in the name of the conservator for the benefit of the ward. So guardianships, as negative as they are often seen, and rightfully seen sometimes in the press, they can do a lot of good. when somebody is being victimized by, again, typically somebody they know and trust.
Doris, Katie mentioned that a significant number of these cases of taking advantage of the elderly are done by people within the family. So tell me how a court case goes if people within the family and those closest who aren't being reported are now involved in the court case, or am I wrong about that?
Well, I'll give you an example. The very first instance, I think it was the very first instance in which I dipped my toe into these water, not the very first, but close to, it was a pretty egregious case. And it was a mother and daughter. And the daughter was both financially exploiting and being emotionally abusive. Her son, the grandson, was physically abusing the grandmother, actually threw her down the stairs and hit her with a stick with a nail in it. This was a woman in her 90s who had suffered two strokes already. So it was a pretty egregious situation. But it was a family where law enforcement and social services had been involved over many, many years. This was not something that sprang up overnight. But it was clear that this woman was not able to care for herself, and her money was disappearing. She was physically in danger. No one was attending to her health care needs. So the Department of Social Services petitions the court and says, this person needs a guardian and conservator. And in the meantime, they call me up and say, Doris, can you serve in that capacity? And in that instance, the county attorney or the city attorney acts as the attorney that petitions the court on behalf of social services. They nominate someone like me or Katie or whomever to take on the role of guardian and conservator. And that's what happened in that case. And what that does for the person who steps into that role as guardian, it can actually be very risky. And I don't know whether Katie's had this sort of circumstance come up, but I actually had to go out and fire the quote unquote paid caregivers who had been hired by the daughter. And then the daughter shows up and she starts, you know, a ruckus, police had to be called. You know, you're putting yourself in danger's way to protect these elderly people when you're acting in that role. Thankfully, in that case, over a period of time, I was able to sort of put some separation between the two. It took quite a long time, actually, to sort it all out. But the end result was that this woman was able to live in her home for another couple of years to be safe, to enjoy her own property and wealth for a long time. We kept her home, did not put her in a nursing home. And then we had caregivers that were able to care for her in a home setting for another 10 months or so, where she died very loved by the people that she lived with and well cared for. So, you know, that's a really good outcome.
That's, well, that's got so many emotions attached to it. We are talking about legal guardianship and the elderly. That's Doris Gelman telling that story, Gelman Law. Here in Charlottesville. Katie Caverly is also with us from I-Corps here in Charlottesville. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. All right, here we are. Thanks for joining us here on The Wren. Legal guardianship and the elderly. Ladies, while we were on that break, the thought comes to mind about intermittent capacity, because wouldn't there be people that have, whether it's medical illness or for some other reason, where you haven't reached some point in life and you need an assistant forevermore. So who wants to take that on? Doris, Katie?
I think a little bit of a discussion about capacity in general, and then also the role that it plays in the guardianship process, is probably appropriate. And then, Katie, stop me if there's something you feel like you want to throw in there. Incapacity is not merely someone showing bad judgment. or making decisions that we don't like or that make us angry or that even are foolish. So if my mother decides she wants to go spend all her money in Las Vegas and I don't like that and I think it's crazy, that's too bad. She's able to make that decision and it's her money to do what she wants with. That is not incapacity. There is such a thing as fluctuating capacity, which might be caused by any number of things, mental illness, an infection. Urinary tract infections are very common for that sort of things. And one of the things that as professionals in this area, and I think Katie will agree with me, is that the only way to truly know whether someone is incapacitated is to eliminate possibilities that might be temporary. And by that, as I said, urinary tract infections, malnutrition, medication errors, lack of medication when it's necessary, all those sorts of things need to be eliminated. Unfortunately, very often in the court process, that is not what happens. And I'll come back and talk more about that in the court setting. I don't know if Katie had something she wanted to add to the fluctuating capacity issue.
Only that I feel as though the legal system isn't well equipped to really handle people who are intermittently capacitated. It's a switch. It's either on or off, right? The judge is going to make a determination as to whether or not an individual is capacitated or incapacitated, and hopefully they will do so on the basis of evidence, medical evidence, testimony from family, friends, what have you. The difficulty is, and we have clients who fall into this category. Let's take mental health disorder and specifically bipolar disorder. We are assigned guardian and conservator for individuals who, when not compliant with their medications, are truly incapacitated, meaning they cannot make decisions in their own best interest. They are incapable of the types of executive function decision making that most of us would make. To Doris's point, it's not merely unwise or reckless, cavalier decision making. It is really hampered decision making. However, that same individual, when compliant with their medication, is capacitated. But the law is not very good at distinguishing the two, right? The decision is either they're capacitated or not. And those mental health cases, or often two substance abuse cases, right? If somebody's abusing alcohol or a drug, they may very well fit the definition of legal incapacity. But if they are sober, they're capacitated. And it's difficult for the law, I think, to wrestle with that. I wish there was some change, albeit I'll be the first to admit I don't know what that change would be. So Doris, I'll let you weigh in from there.
Funny you should say that. There is right now, there are some deficiencies in the law. There's also some deficiencies in the people that conduct these proceedings. And by that, I mean the courts. There's also someone involved that's called a guardian ad litem. The law also requires a medical evaluation report. That is the basic evidence that this hearing is held on. But here's the problem. When the person that is petitioning the court for guardianship submits a medical evaluation that's done by a doctor who really is doing this in a hurry and is checking off some boxes and has not really closely examined this patient or reviewed their history, and they simply write down schizoaffective disorder, incapacitated, the judge doesn't have any insight into that. They haven't necessarily even seen, they may not even be in the courtroom. And the guardian ad litem is responsible for visiting with that person and being the eyes and ears of the court and reporting to the court, to the judge at the hearing, their impressions. And these guardian ad litems, we do have a system of training them, but in my view, it's somewhat deficient. It's 6 hours of training. We have some very inexperienced attorneys that sometimes take on these roles. They really don't know very much about the issues of incapacity or the elderly. So, I mean, those are real problems. One of the things that's come up very recently is that the legislature in Virginia, because of things like Free Britney and Peter Max and, you know, all the other popular media things, as well as some pretty egregious cases that have happened in Virginia, has taken up the subject. There was throughout the last, I believe it was about a year or so, the judicial legislative, or I'm sorry, the Joint Legislative Audit and Report Committee, known as JLARC, took up the entire subject of guardianship, looking at the entire code and listening to stakeholders all across the Commonwealth, and just recently submitted a report to the legislature citing many of these deficiencies in the law. And one of them, which I find very interesting, is the need for training for the court personnel, including the judges, including the GALs, to understand these issues, like the issue of capacity, for example. And the judges will tell you, they'll stand right in front of the lawyers like myself and say, we don't know this area of the law. We rely on you to tell us. And they're sorry about that when they ask me that question, because then I don't shut up.
Again, Doris Gelman here, who we're glad to have talking for the hour today on legal guardianship in the elderly, along with Katie Caverly. So, Doris, you provided me with some stories and homework in preparation for today's show. And one of the stories was frightening, to say the least. It was a couple years old. It was in the New Yorker. A story, let me find my notes, about Rudy and Rennie, an older married couple who lived in Las Vegas, had their own house, had obviously had a healthy life, had accumulated a fair amount of wealth, lived on their own. Their daughter lived a short distance away and visited them daily. And then one day they came home and found that they were being made wards of the court. And this article, it just made me so sad and so angry at the same time. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Well, yes, I can. I can talk about it quite a lot. I'll try to do the Reader's Digest version. They made a movie that was somewhat based on that story called I Care a Lot. And when that movie came out, it's on Netflix for anybody that wants to watch it. It's fictional, but it's loosely based on that story. When I saw that movie, within the first 10 minutes, Katie will remember this, I texted her and I said, Katie, oh my God, they've made our lives into a movie. And it's not really, because we're really at the opposite end of this. But what happened was, there was an attorney in that state, in Nevada, who managed to abuse holes in the law specific to Nevada. It is not the same in every state, that allowed her to herself petition for guardianship and speak with the judge ex parte, in other words, with no other party there present, not the person who was being for whom a guardian was being sought, or anyone else, and had the judge name her as guardian for these people. So this was a very abbreviated process, no fail safes for the persons involved. And she did this like clockwork. It was a business for her. And she would separate them from their property and sell their real estate and empty their bank accounts and put them in some rotten nursing home. And that would be that, and everything would be gone. Well, she was arrested, right? And charged with a crime. She's in jail, so far as I know. As a result of that story, there is a silver lining to that. Nevada seriously reevaluated the whole legal scheme for naming guardians, and changed it substantially. And that's really kind of the starting point for this whole national outcry about guardians. Casey Kasem is another very famous person who was involved in guardianship litigation and his daughter is a very strong advocate against guardianship, which is a little problematic when I talk about, if you remember the story at the beginning that I told you about the little old lady who was being abused by her own family, where guardianship rescued her from that. You know, so how do you distinguish between the abusive ones that are the guardians and the abusive ones that are they're being rescued from?
Well, and you mentioned, again, this New Yorker article, which is a couple years old now. When you read it, and you're saying that the state of Nevada has changed some rules, but the article is telling this story over the course of several years. This right. didn't happen in just a couple months, right? Rudy and Rennie lost everything, and they were separated from their daughter for years. And they ran into, because of the nursing homes, they ran into dozens and probably hundreds of other people who had the same thing happen, correct?
That's correct.
And it wasn't just the attorney who was doing this, because it was the way it read to me in the article, the judge knew exactly what she was doing.
Yes. Yes.
As well as other people, other players in this program.
Right. And the movie that I referenced, I Care a Lot, they really play that up a lot. There's a doctor, there's a judge, there's all kinds of people who, in collusion with this professional guardian, who reminded me so much of Katie, except that Katie does a good job at these. She's not.
I don't look like Rosamund Pike either. I have blonde hair, but that's where the similarities end.
Yeah, well, she played a really smart character, so that fits. But the movie is very, reflective of that situation, that this took a number of people to pull this off. There was, a particular assisted living that was going along with this and keeping other people from reaching the person that had been put there in a lockdown unit, and, all those elements were in the movie as well. But the upshot is that the outcry that came out of that New Yorker article resulted in the system being changed dramatically in Nevada. And it is also undergoing serious scrutiny here in Virginia, although we're much better than Nevada ever was about providing protections to people.
Yeah, Doris, I'll interject if I can, Rick. Written into the Virginia code is language that a guardian may not unreasonably obstruct their ward from pre-existing relationships. And that harkens back to Nevada's handling of matters and Casey Kasem and whatnot. But so when we serve as guardian, if there's a daughter that's been a participant in her dad's life, we can't suddenly stop daughter from having a relationship with her dad. That's embedded in the Virginia code. So there are already some things that Virginia does better than many other states, but no state is perfect. You got to find the right guardian and conservator, people you can trust.
What is an example of when an emergency ex parte petition might need to take place?
I don't know that I've ever heard of an emergency ex parte
petition. Phrase it in the proper manner then, because I'm probably using incorrect legalese. Yeah. My father is probably cringing when he hears this. But there must be emergency situations.
There are emergency situations. In fact, Katie and I have been involved in them together. And I've been involved in another one where I was being named as guardian. And when you usually those are done by the Commonwealth, right? It's usually the Department of Social Services. In fact, the law says only the Department of Social Services can bring an emergency for the protection and safety of someone who needs someone to protect them. And the difficulty with that is once you're awarded that emergency guardianship, you got to go back every 15 days to be heard again. The judge has to reappoint you every 15 days. if you're the guardian and you have to go to the bank and justify what you're doing, and every 15 days you've got to bring them a new order, that is really cumbersome. If you know anything about the process of getting legal authority for a bank to recognize a power of attorney, this is five times worse. And Katie and I have been down that road, if you recall.
I will interject, Rick. You know, guardians and conservators are the option of last resort. In fact, the law says you've got to look for the least restrictive means, and there is nothing about a guardianship or conservatorship that is not restrictive. And I just take this opportunity, if anybody out there is listening and is 18 or older, complete a durable and healthcare power of attorney. You know, when you think about some of our nation's most notorious kind of right to die cases, Terry Schiavo comes up. Remember that case? Terry Schiavo wasn't an elderly woman. She was 26. But she had no appointed medical decision maker, and it turned into an argument between her parents and her husband as to what should happen to Terry. So if you're listening and you're a legal adult and don't have your estate documents drawn up, you should contact somebody like Doris or some other estate attorney and have those crafted so that you do not end up in a guardianship. And I say that as somebody who serves as guardian, and we're good at it. We're thoughtful. We're compassionate. It matters to us. We take it seriously, but you still don't want to wind up there. So have your estate documents in order.
Thank you for that advertisement. The check is in the mail.
As we are talking about legal guardianship and the elderly with Doris Gelman, she does Gelman Law, where she exclusively practices elder law in Charlottesville. Katie Caverly, she's the owner and managing director, I-Corps here in Charlottesville. Let's take our break, and we will be right back. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call. Thanks for being with us, 2022. Again, talking about legal guardianship and the elderly. Katie and Doris, a lot of people spending time with family over the recent holidays, and now here we are talking about guardianship and the elderly. Are there any notes or signs or anything that people might be coming home from the holidays and talking about with their spouse or other family members and going, you know, that's starting to bother me. Did you see that? That are more important than others when you want to start talking about guardianship amongst the elderly?
Meaning when a family member might think that mom or dad is approaching incapacity? Is that the question, Rick?
Yes.
I'm sure Doris has many examples she can share. One of the things I often look for is when an elder is being made to feel an intense negative emotion around money. That always bothers us, meaning somebody is making them feel guilty or anxious or obligated. When I see those types of emotions on the face of elders, in the faces and voices of elders in connection to their own money, I perk up. Because when we see exploitation, it can take a couple of forms. I mean, it can be quite nasty. And sometimes it's in the eyes of the exploiter, vengeance, right? Perhaps mom or dad was not a great parent, domineering. And as they age, then that power dynamic shifts and suddenly the adult child is thinking, now you need me. And there is that sort of tone of vengeance to the exploitation. Sometimes it's desperation on the point or the part of a family member. They've got their own financial insecurities and, you know, I'm going to inherit it anyway. What's it matter? And it's just as insidious, but somehow less overtly nasty. But all forms of exploitation. And so as we get to know a client and we are witnessing those intensely negative emotions around their own money, we tend to go exploring and figuring out what's going on there.
Can you talk a little bit about, Doris, can you talk a bit about some of the more, I guess, the cases that have been in the public press mm-hmm. a bit? You mentioned Peter Max mm-hmm. earlier in the show. We've had Michelle Nichols, who played Star Trek's Lieutenant Uhura. And they've both been on the, is it proper to say, negative end of guardianship abuse?
Well, I don't know that that's the case. To be honest, I have enough real stories that I follow in my own practice to be able to pay close attention to what's happening in some of those famous cases. And often it's not a case of abuse necessarily that's going on. It's a case that it's in dispute. So either the person themselves, and I think that that's part of the problem in the case with Lieutenant Uhuru, or Michelle Nichols is the actress's name, where she believes she doesn't have dementia and doesn't need a guardian. And there's some friend in her life that's been living on her property and in her life for a long time. I don't believe it's an intimate relationship, but that person has stepped in and taken over a lot of the decision-making for her with her consent. And then I believe her son stepped in and said, this person is nobody to us. He shouldn't be making decisions. He's taking advantage of my mother. So there's a dispute between the son and the friend and his own mother as to whether a guardianship is necessary and who should be in that role. And that is often the case. When you've got someone and you tell them, you don't have the capacity to take care of yourself anymore. So-and-so is taking over. Wouldn't you fight that? And, oh, by the way, you're going to lose your right to vote. You're going to lose your right to drive. You're going to lose your right to marry the person of your choice. You're going to lose the right to own guns. In fact, it becomes a criminal offense if you have them. You lose all your civil rights when you come under this order. This is a big deal. So who wouldn't fight that, right? I think one of the more interesting cases that I did send you was the one that I actually know of. I know the attorney that was involved in that, where someone who was purported to be a boyfriend, some number of years younger than the mother, actually absconded with a person, took her out of state after they got a guardianship order and married her. And then took her off to California, and they went through quite a lot of expense to reach out through the state lines to get control again of the mother, only to find out he had taken her all the way to Germany, where it was next to impossible to get them back. And when they finally did, it was at tremendous expense to the estate. So these things are quite serious, and people go to quite a lot of length to get control of somebody else's life.
Doris, you mentioned several things about that the ward gives up. And I have a small list here, or not so small, really. The ward, once they have someone else as their guardianship, the ward gives up the right to make a contract, including the right to choose their own lawyer, the right to control their own assets and make financial decisions, the right to remain in their own home and protect it from sale, the right to protect and enjoy their personal property, the right to choose where to live, the right to accept or refuse medical treatment, including antipsychotic drugs, the right to decide social environments and contacts, the right to assure prompt payment of taxes and liabilities, the right to vote, the right to drive, the right to marry, and the right to complain. It's no wonder that this has taken on such a negative aspect, because it seems so easy to abuse if the person who has the guardianship does anything, I mean, if they have any sort of negativity in their system.
So one of the things that people should know is that the process in Virginia does allow the, before the guardian is named, does allow for certain things to be carved out of that list. So you can have a limited conservator whose powers are limited. So for those things that you mentioned that, you know, have to do with their money and property, you can say, for example, that they cannot sell the real estate without going before the court and getting the court's approval to do that. And sometimes that's appropriate, especially if you have an unknown quantity. The conservator is also bonded, and surety is generally required if there are significant assets. And what that means is they have to take out an insurance policy so that if they end up, for example, stealing the money, the insurance company would reimburse the estate for that. So there's a guarantee that, you know, or a form of a guarantee that the money is not going to go all down the drain. They're also supervised. You don't just get to be conservator and not do have any oversight in Virginia. You're overseen by the Commissioner of Accounts, which is an officer of the court. You have to report to them. I think the first inventory is due 4 months after you're appointed, and you have to tell them all of the things that you've taken control of and the value of them. 2 months later, you have to give an accounting. What did you spend? What did you sell? What did you take in? And then you do an accounting once a year before the court, and that has to be approved and it's audited. So it's not quite that simple to simply sell off people's assets without someone looking over your shoulder in Virginia. You can, for example, I had a woman who for whom I was named guardian who had been historically very active in the political arena and voted and registered voters, and she was very concerned about losing her right to vote. So we preserved it. We had the judge order her able to vote, which makes sense. We don't test anybody else for their ability to make good decisions when they vote, as we've seen. Why should they lose the right to vote? So you can preserve those things. You cannot preserve the right to own guns once somebody is deemed incapacitated.
Doris, I'll interject. I even had a ward where we asked that the court retain their testamentary capacity. This was a husband and wife. The guardianship was brought by social services. Neighbors had called, and they were in pretty dire straits. In fact, it went into an emergency hearing. We were appointed both guardian and conservator for the husband and wife. She unfortunately died shortly thereafter, but this was a couple that had almost a pathological anxiety around spending money. So they were living in squalor and not buying food, not paying for medicines, not visiting the doctor, and were in terrible shape. Well, when we were appointed, to your point, one of the first things we had to do was prepare an inventory. What do they own? What are their sources of income? What are their assets? And upon doing the inventory, we discovered they had millions. And we went back and asked the judge, could the husband, who we felt had a pretty good grasp of his money and for a long time had invested his funds, but again, had this sort of pathological fear of spending it. But anyway, we'd gone back to the judge and said, were you willing to restore his testamentary capacity for a period of time? And the judge said yes. And we brought an attorney in who drew up a will for this guy. So there are ways to carve out certain rights you can retain. We've seen driving privileges retained, voting privileges, to your example, Doris. And again, in a what I suspect is a fairly unusual case, even testamentary capacity retained.
Well, that's nice to know that Virginia has decided not to go black or white and has found a way to make the law in an acceptable manner. And I would think that knowing that you can do it this way, Katie, has allowed people the grace to accept guardianship a little easier than they may otherwise.
Yeah, it's, you know, the majority of our clients for whom we are appointed guardian and conservator are so incapacitated that our presence is not a source of angst for them. But we have had appointments where it's a thin line between that decision point of capacitated or incapacitated, and they're angry, understandably so. And we take a really slow, thoughtful, sort of trust-building approach there. We try and preserve some of their self-efficacy, some of their decision-making on things that they can control and should control. So, you know, a good guardian doesn't go in there and wrap their ward in bubble wrap and stick them in the cupboard. A good guardian is trying to figure out, what is this person capable of, and how do I allow them to remain stewards of some aspects of their own lives? And even the wards who were really angry that we were there on the scene, the vast majority of the time we can slowly build trust, and they come to see us as useful to their overall well-being.
So, I'm laughing in the background because it's a conversation I often have. People will call me up, and you know, I probably have this two or three times a day, where someone will call me up and say, I need to get a power of attorney over my mother, and I start to laugh and I say, okay, well, have your mother call me, because you don't get to get a power of attorney over anyone, and they'll say, oh, well she can't, and I'm like, well, why can't she? And they say, well, she's got dementia, she's crazy. And I'm like, well, she can't write a power of attorney anyway. Well, so the next question, of course, is, well, what do I do? And I said, well, you're going to end up having to petition the court for guardianship. And we get into a discussion about that. And, it, you know, what they're trying to do is put mom in the nursing home, right? And mom is kicking and screaming and not agreeing to go and doesn't want to do this, that, or the other thing. And what I explain to people is, you know, even if you had power of attorney, it's a piece of paper that says you have the legal authority to do those things. You're not actually going to be able to wrap mom up in bubble wrap and put her in the car and haul her off to a nursing home, because she's going to dig her heels in the ground and not go anyway. Not just because you have a piece of paper is not going to make that any easier. Well, a guardianship is just the same, except it's a piece of paper from the judge. Right. You have an order from the judge, and yes, you can bring the law to bear on those sorts of things. But it's still not any easier without going through that process that Katie's describing, of developing a relationship, of building the trust. And more than anything else, I try to explain to people, it's absolutely essential to preserve their dignity in this process. These are not children, even if they're incapacitated. They're older, they have a lifetime of experience and knowledge, and they deserve our respect. And you know, I really see that as our role, both as lawyer and as guardian or trustee or fiduciary in whatever capacity. And it's really important to preserve that.
I think we discussed this a bit earlier without the official title. By the way, we are talking about legal guardianship and the elderly, Doris Gelman from Gelman Law, and Katie Caverly from ICOR Charlottesville. We've got not even 3 minutes left here. But the official title is Virginia Public Guardianship Program. Doris, Katie, can someone talk about that briefly?
So the public guardianship program is designed for people who have no resources. So at least in our area, in the Jefferson Area Planning District and a couple other counties beyond that, there is an agency that has been granted the role of public guardian, and they are paid by a fund that's allocated every year by the legislature. They are grossly underfunded. There are not nearly enough available public guardian slots. I think we have something like 700 on the waiting list right now. It is a subject much in scrutiny by the legislature as I speak. So it's a great idea. In practice, it doesn't work very well because we don't have enough of them and they don't get paid well enough.
So would you say that they're underfunded and the legislature is looking at it? Do you expect that the upcoming legislature and with the change in administration, that anything will be done about it?
It's a really hot topic. The topic of guardianship in general is a very hot topic. If you're interested in that, I can send you the JLARC report. The report highlighted 44 areas that needed addressing, of which public guardianship is one. Stay tuned. A lot more to be said on this subject.
So, Doris, let me ask you, do you think that local businesses such as I-Corps are equally underfunded with trouble servicing all their clients?
Well, I don't know that Katie's underfunded. They generally are servicing people who do have funds, so the public guardianship does not come into issue with that. Occasionally, we have people who have very limited funds, and we're really just seeking to get them, for example, Medicaid eligible, and then the conservator steps out of the picture once that's done. Katie very kindly and very generously has frequently taken on that role and does not get paid for it, does it on a pro bono basis. And there are a handful of other people that will do that as well. There's a couple of other attorneys and another fiduciary that I know that will take a pro bono case for that limited purpose.
Again, a conversation today about legal guardianship and the elderly. You can call up Doris Gelman at Gelman Law to discuss elder law here in Charlottesville. Katie Caverly is the managing director and owner at I-Corps Charlottesville. Thank you so much for the conversation today, ladies and listeners. Learn what you need to learn and do your best for your family. Take care.
Thank you so much for having us, Rick. Really appreciate it.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.